The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning. We're obviously missing two of our colleagues this morning. Justice Lansinger is recovering from a fall from last week. She's read the briefs. She'll either watch or listen to oral arguments, and she'll be participating in the cases this morning. And Justice Pfeiffer also is not here. He's read the briefs and also will be participating in the oral arguments, or in the cases this morning. The first case is 04-1554, State of Ohio versus Donald Lavelle Craig. Mr. Ray.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Nathan Ray, and I represent the appellant defendant, Mr. Donald Lavelle Craig. With the court's permission, I would like to reserve 10 minutes of my time for rebuttal here this morning.
Watch your time there on the clock.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, what I would like to start with and focus this court's attention on this morning would start with proposition of law number two. Basically, Your Honors, what that covers and what that is covered in the briefs was the other act's testimony that came in at this trial. As this case is aware, this is a capital case. It involved the rape and killing of a, I believe, a 12-year-old girl. There was a significant amount of DNA involved in this case. I believe that there was a expert who testified that the DNA in this case tied him into this case to a degree, into the millions or zillions. Despite that, though, the court in this case allowed in the other acts evidence that you had before it in before you in the second proposition of law. As the court is aware, specifically, the general rule is that other acts evidence does not come in. However, the common law rule has been codified in the Ohio Revised Code at 2945.59, as well as the Ohio Rule of Evidence 404B. The general rule being that it's not, shouldn't be introduced, then the question becomes, was there error in this case for the introduction of this? The court in this case, and when I say the court, I'm talking about the Common Pleas Court, gave a limiting instruction and then a jury instruction in this case. The limiting instruction came prior to the other act's testimony in this case at the trial, and then the instructions, the jury instructions at the close of the case. Specifically, the court instructed the jury that they were to look at the other act's testimony for two purposes. First, they were to look at the identity of the perpetrator and or the intent and motive regarding the murder in this case. As this court is aware, it has previously dealt with this issue. Specifically in State versus Lowe, there was an opinion, and the court called into question, not necessarily called into question, maybe that's not an appropriate term, but this court has looked at the use of other acts testimony for purposes of identification very tightly, and doing so with the understanding that this cannot then become an argument, well, he did it previously, he must have done it now. That's not the purpose of the other act's testimony. So the other issue then for the court was whether or not, or for the jury, was then whether or not this was some kind of a modus operandi. In other words, was there a motive, intent, purpose to commit the aggravated murder? What I have done, Your Honor, is this. Or justices, I have kind of gone through the evidence that was presented at trial and kind of a factual differentiation between Ms. Lavelle's testimony, the 1996 murder trial that Mr. Craig was on trial for, kind of differentiate between these two cases and why this was an improper admission of this other act's testimony. Specifically, with regards to the victims themselves, this was a 17-year-old in the other acts. I believe this was a 12-year-old in this case here. The victim testified in this case that she was taken to a home. She felt that it was ransacked, but she didn't know whether it was abandoned or not. The victim in this case, she was found in an abandoned home. The victim in the other act's testimony indicated that she had gone into the house on her own to use the restroom. In this case here, there's an indication that the coroner testified that there was strangulation, and that's how the victim died. In the other act's evidence, there was no indication of strangulation. There was an indication possibly that he had pushed her face into a pillow, but there was no strangulation involved. After this was alleged to have occurred, I'm speaking about the other act's testimony, they then left the home. They, at that point in time, went to a store, went to a drive-thru, and then the other act's victim was taken home and dropped off. In the other act's case, there was no indication, and I believe that there was testimony of penetration in that case. There was no indication of any DNA, any swabs, any spermatozoa, anything that would tie Mr. Craig into the case that way. And finally, Your Honors, with regards to the other acts evidence, as the court is aware, after having reviewed this case, the other acts evidence was no billed out of the Summit County Grand Jury.
Counsel, is there a requirement to use appropriately use other acts to show plan, modus operandi, any of that permissible ability to use this? Is it required that there be a conviction?
Your Honor, I do not believe that there is a requirement under Ohio law.
So the fact that it was no billed really has no bearing here.
My only argument, Your Honor, and under the law, it probably does not have a requirement. Let me answer your question that way. But my thought would be that given the facts that this is other acts evidence, the prejudicial nature of it, I would think, Your Honor, the fact that it was no billed should come into play for this court's decision as to whether or not this was a proper decision by the trial court. Under Ohio law, there's no requirement that there be an actual conviction in order to use other acts evidence, Your Honor. What I would like to do now, with the court's permission, is kind of tie the other acts evidence that came in at this trial into the 11th proposition of law, dealing with the fact that the death sentence is unreliable in this case. The court has in front of you the transcript of this case. You have the transcript of the proceedings. You know all the testimony that came in, and I'm sure you've reviewed it. It's set forth in the Mr. Craig's brief. What I would ask you to focus on would be the factors that Dr. Bindo had testified to, the family members that had testified in this case. Specifically, Dr. Bindo testified that Mr. Craig has a full-scale IQ of 83. Obviously, it's not at the mental retardation level of 70, but it's a low-level IQ. He found that there were four mitigating factors that applied in this case, dealing with his impaired cognitive function, the alcohol, drugs use that Mr. Craig had been involved with, the trauma of the early loss, the emotional deficits that Mr. Craig exhibited, as well as the positive adaption to incarceration. Given those factors, Your Honor, I guess I would tie a final factor into those factors as presented, and that would be the undue impact of the other acts evidence at the mitigation and the sentencing phase of a capital trial. As has been pointed out here this morning, there is no requirement there has to be a prior conviction in order for other acts evidence to come in. However, one of the concerns that I believe that this court should address in capital cases is, and look at it in this case specifically, is the fact that there's impact not only at the guilt phase of a trial, but also the carryover effect that the other acts evidence can have on the sentencing phase of the trial. As the court is aware, in a capital case, this is the only case that a jury actually has any indication or say in what a sentence is going to be in a case. As a matter of fact, in most trials, the judge instructs the jury not to consider what a sentence is going to be in this case. In a capital case, they specifically make a recommendation as to what that sentence is going to be. This is under the old law. The jury had before it the options of death, 20 to life, 30 to life. Life without parole was not an option for this jury. So the other acts evidence that came in this case, I think, and I would ask this court to look at as to whether or not this would have impacted the mitigation phase of this case.
Where in the record would we be able to find some indication that the other act evidence had played a role in the sentencing verdict that was returned by the jury?
Therein lies the rub, Judge, Your Honor, because there is no indication, and I for me in reviewing the record, Your Honor, there is no indication where I can point you to and say, look at what they did right here. Obviously, if there was, and they said we reviewed the other acts evidence, the court could say, that's definitely reversible error. Unfortunately, I can't do that. Okay. My thought is, what I'm requesting the court to do is take into consideration the fact that, given the nature of these cases, and as the court is aware, this is a horrendous crime in this case, you double that up with the testimony presented by the other acts victim in this case, which in reading the transcript, I'm sure you'll agree with me that it was also horrendous testimony. Those two together, Your Honor, when you have the other acts evidence that comes in a capital case, I can't point you to something that says, look, they relied on it. But I would just ask you to carefully consider whether this other acts evidence was appropriate in this case, given the fact that this is a capital case, given the fact that this court, this jury was then required after hearing this atrocious other acts evidence.
Well, I mean, we have the rape murder of a 12-year-old.
Yes, sir.
She had gone to a friend's house. Obviously, your parents are waiting for her to come home, and she doesn't come home. I mean, so you have the factual situation, and then evidence comes in that Mr. Craig has done this again from the prosecution side. This is the second time this has occurred. And though, as you correctly point out, first instance was no build, but the evidence is there. So, I mean, given that, and given that it is a death penalty case, what rule of law do you want us to write with respect to other act evidence in death penalty cases along the argument that you're making to us now? I mean, should we make a special rule on other act evidence in death penalty cases, or is that a legislative prerogative?
Two thoughts. Number one, Your Honor, I can't tell you there should be a bright line rule that in all capital cases other acts evidence should not come in. I can't say that. My thought here this morning as it relates to Mr. Craig's case is to look at the mitigating fact or the mitigation that was presented. And this is a young man, came from a good family background, had a lot going for him. Dr. Bindo presented some strong points in his mitigation with regards to Mr. Craig. There was some good mitigation here. And as you pointed out, this is a horrendous crime, Your Honor. This is the rape and death of a 12-year-old. However, when you take into consideration that not only was this jury considering that case, but they were also considering this other horrendous rape of a 17-year-old, I think that, and I can't give you a bright line and I can't give you a test, Your Honor. All I would suggest is that on a case-by-case basis, this court look at whether or not the other acts evidence was so horrendous in nature as to unduly prejudice Mr. Craig in both his penalty phase, in both the guilt phase and also the penalty phase of the trial. And this is a bifurcated trial, and the court is aware that the jury not only makes a determination with regards to the guilt, but also to the punishment in this case. And I believe, and I would just ask this court to consider any carryover effect that there might be from one phase
but
to another.
But counsel, you cannot with certainty point to anything, as was asked previously, that would show that the jury was unduly prejudiced by the fact that there was introduction of other acts testimony that showed an activity that comported in so many ways with the activity that was directed against this victim.
That's correct, Your Honor. I cannot point you to anything in particular.
And if you then look at the other evidence that was introduced in this trial in the guilt phase, the DNA,
yes, ma'am.
There is ample, more than ample, evidence presented to the jury to allow them to arrive at that decision, the decision of guilt.
With regards to the decision of guilt, I would agree with you 100%, especially if you exclude everything but the DNA. I mean, the DNA came back at 2 billion to 1.
Yeah, we all know the conclusiveness of testing such as that.
Correct.
So then you're saying that the jury, in light of the mitigation evidence that was presented, mm-hmm. the family members, the psychiatrist, the prison officials, et cetera, or corrections officers, et cetera, they must have ignored all that because they focused on the other acts evidence?
No. Let me try and clarify myself here, Justice O'Connor. As you've pointed out, there was strong evidence in this case with regards to the guilt phase, okay? It almost was to the point where the other acts testimony was almost not needed, but it was allowed in. And as the court is aware, and you've pointed out, Your Honor, it doesn't have to be a conviction in order to be admissible, but there are standards under Ohio law that, and under Ohio, this court's case law, that certain requirements have to be met. But my thought is that the carryover effect, the unnecessariness of the other acts evidence, then becomes a carryover effect into the mitigation phase. And I can't point you to anything in the transcript where it says, Judge, this is what happened. All I can suggest to the court is there was mitigation that was presented. There was strong mitigation that was presented in this case with regards to Mr. Craig. The question becomes, and once again, I'm not here to discredit or to say this was not a horrendous case. This was a horrendous case. But the fact that you, on top of everything else, you then laid on there that other acts evidence. My thought is, on a case-by-case basis, Judge, you have to look at whether or not this other acts evidence was so prejudicial, both at the penalty phase or at the guilt phase, as well as the penalty phase, for purposes of reaching a decision in this case. That would be my position, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, I would simply reserve any remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Ray.
Rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Cassay.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, my name is Richard Cassay, representing the state in this case. Addressing counsel's argument that the the evidence of the other act somehow could impact the jury's verdict in the case, I guess if you had the right case, it's theoretically possible. For instance, if you had erroneously admitted other act evidence, very strong mitigation, and evidence of guilt that is not as conclusive as in this case, I think that argument would at least be colorable. However, I don't think even in that type of situation it could succeed, as it cannot in this case, putting aside any other consideration, because number one, the trial court, Judge Cosgrove in this case, wrote a very detailed and thoughtful sentencing order where she upheld the jury's recommendation. Among other things, number one, there's not a word in that sentencing order where Judge Cosgrove even mentioned, much less was influenced by the other act evidence. So I think that in and of itself would answer the issue. Number
Counsel,
two. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
If I understand the defense's argument, they're saying you really didn't need the other acts evidence in light of the DNA testimony. And by putting in the other acts, because you didn't need it, your prejudicial value or your prejudicial effect outweighed its value. and therefore unfairly tainted the mitigation phase. What's your response to that?
I think that would be the premise of a proposition that the state has to gauge beforehand the weight of the evidence that it has and make a determination that because the state has a strong case, we can't use other admissible evidence. I don't think that would be a proper statement of the law. It's certainly not, to my knowledge, a statement of the law as it exists at this point in time. The state can't know what the jury is going to think. The state certainly is allowed to admit whatever is admissible under the laws of evidence and the federal and state constitution. Now, if Your Honor, if you're suggesting that we have to make a determination, well, we don't want to gild the lily, if that would be a way to put it. You know, perhaps nobody wants to gild the lily, but when you have this, when you have a capital case, when you have this type of incident, I think you cannot limit the state by saying you have to exclude certain admissible evidence, because with hindsight, we think you had more than enough. So I don't know if that's a good answer, but it's the answer that I have. getting back to what I was talking about, Judge Cosgrove's sentencing order, as a cure for the theoretical possibility that Mr. Ray poses to you, the second prevention or the preventative device here is this court's independent review. Certainly, this court is not going to be influenced by any other act evidence in its independent determination whether the aggravating circumstances beyond a reasonable doubt outweighed the mitigating evidence. So, as a practical matter, I can't conceive of a defendant in Ohio being sentenced to death, the execution actually being carried out because the jury may have been tainted by other act evidence. And certainly in this case, the other act evidence was not erroneously admitted. Again, Judge Cosgrove wrote a very lengthy and thoughtful and detailed memorandum on the issue. You know, I certainly can't improve on it, but some of the points she made, you know, she cited the correct test being, is there substantial evidence that the other incident occurred, and then is it relevant to, among other things, the factors delineated in evidence rule 404B. Judge Cosgrove found substantial proof, number one. It was bound over to the grand jury upon a finding of probable cause, and she found the other act witness, Lavelle Calhoun, to be a credible witness. You know, certainly that was Judge Cosgrove's call to make on the credibility issue, and I think it's, you know, close to being beyond review at this point in time. then she looked to what it was relevant to, identity and motive. The similarities between the Calhoun incident and the incident with Rosie Davenport are legion. Besides the nature of the sexual assaults, you had the taking Lavelle Calhoun into this abandoned house to look that it had been ransacked. The apartment, the basement of the apartment at 156 Maple Street where Rosie Davenport's body was found. When you look at the pictures, well, it's just a dank and dirty and ugly dungeon. So you have that, you have the restraint, you have the, again, the nature of the sexual acts. So there's just many, many, many similarities here. Next of all, and I think very commendably, Judge Cosgrove not only gave the limiting instruction in the general jury instructions, but also before Lavelle Calhoun testified, she gave the limiting instruction. I've read a lot of transcripts in doing criminal appeals, and rarely, if ever, have I seen a trial court do that. Maybe they should. Maybe they all should. But be that as it may, Judge Cosgrove did it, and obviously the presumption has to be that the jury was listening to what Judge Cosgrove told them. So in short, to my view, there's simply no way that this other act evidence was erroneously admitted. Obviously, if we're going to have a rule that the state can't use what it's allowed to use because there has to be, with hindsight, a judgment, well, you really didn't need that, so now we're going to say it's prejudicial. But even if it was, again, the sentencing order in this court's review are going to prevent an inappropriate or unlawful execution to any defendant in the state of Ohio. I think I have covered what was raised by the appellant in this case. I'll be happy to answer any questions on any other issue that the court may have.
Let me ask, you seem to agree that the sentencing by the trial judge here was an error on the kidnapping charge. Is that correct?
Because the actual sentence, yeah.
But not the rape charges.
Yeah, the sentence at the sentencing hearing, Judge Cosgrove pronounced a sentence of 10 years, flat 10. In the sentencing entry, it's a flat 8. Now, if you would reverse that order, you'd have an error because then the sentence would be increased outside of the presence of the defendant. But specifically to this case, this was an offense in late February, early March of 1996. At that point in time, the kidnapping sentencing statute and all the felony statutes did not provide for definite sentences as we had under SB 2. So, when you read the sentencing transcript, you will see that it was Judge Cosgrove's firm intent to impose the maximum sentence under the law applicable. That would have been 10 to 25. Instead, she gave 10, then 8. So on that issue, it appears to me that the sentencing on the kidnapping was erroneous, and that would necessitate a remand.
I'm still not clear why. I understand that argument. That appears to be clear. She used the wrong statute. On the rape charges, though, why do you distinguish between the kidnapping and rape charges? Didn't she use the SB 2 statute also there?
The rape convictions are distinguishable, in my view, Mr. Chief Justice, because under the former law and the present law, the sentence is the same.
That's your reason, because they're the same.
Yes.
So to remand it would be a futile act or fruitless act.
What would be the point? Yeah.
Except that it would make the record complete, proper.
It would make it crystal clear. And the jury was instructed appropriately, to my view. And the rape, it's life, and it's life. So it's still life. Thank you. Thank the court for its attention.
Thank you, Mr. Cassay. Mr. Ray, you've saved a little more than 13 minutes of your time.
I'll be very brief here, Your Honor. In response to Mr. Cassay here, he's indicated that the order put on by Judge Cosgrove in this case failed to mention or did not mention the other acts evidence in this case, and I would concur with Mr. Cassay, I believe, on that. However, as this court is aware and as this court has ruled, judges are presumed to have set aside any prejudices or misunderstand, or they're presumed to know the law correctly and to be able to set aside any feelings that they might have. With regards to the jury, and once again, I cannot point you to anything. However, all I can suggest to you is that in this case, with the other acts evidence, Mr. Craig was forced to defend both cases at the same time, meaning he was forced to defend a rape for which he was not convicted in 91, and he was forced to defend himself against a rape and a murder in this case here. While the Judge Cosgrove might have been in a position to set aside any misunderstandings that there would have been with regards to her position, I respectfully suggest to the court that given the brutality of both of these cases, that the other act's evidence was unduly prejudicial to Mr. Craig in this case and should not have been admitted by the court. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.